Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears on WWGH 107.1 FM. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. It is Thursday, November the 11th, 2021, 14 coming up on 15 minutes past the hour. Scott Spears along with you this morning, and we have got a very special program planned for you on this Veterans Day 2021 for the entire two-hour program this morning, and we thank Terry Klein for setting up this program. Do want to remind people, it's on the news report this morning, but it came late yesterday. Lady Justice was supposed to go back up on top of the courthouse today, and because of the windy weather, that is not going to take place. So if you're headed downtown to the courthouse, don't go. They are looking at the 16th of November now as the day to put Lady Justice back on top the courthouse. Do want to let people know that our exclusive interview with Jim Ganahl, longtime television personality in Columbus, Ohio, meteorologist, will be on today from 5 until 7 p.m. And tomorrow we will repeat that from 2 until 4 p.m. And this is a very exclusive interview. Jim has resisted, as he told me when I was at his home a few weeks ago, doing an interview like this, but we go through his life. We talk about how he got into broadcasting, but also talk about all those hard points in his career. For years, people have talked about his addiction to prescription drugs that he had in the 80s. We go into that in this interview for the first time. We talk about a lawsuit that was filed by a co-worker and what the story was behind that, why he left Channel 4 after 40 years on the air there, and why he's at Channel 6 now, his congestive heart failure, and his appearance on the air, which has become an interesting topic for a lot of people. He talks about it all in this interview. Don't miss it today. From 5:15 until 7 p.m., it's 2 hours, and it's worth the listen, plus a lot of fun stuff, folklore about the weather and things of that nature. And again, repeats tomorrow, 2:15 until 3. As many people know, today is Veterans Day. A lot of people are home today. I know some banks are closed, and I don't think the mail runs today. And as it should be, a very important day. And we are joined in studio this morning by veterans, thanks to Terry Klein. So we're going to open up the program by just kind of going round robin here and have everybody introduce themselves and when they were active or involved in whatever they were involved in, I guess is what we'll start here with. And we'll start over here with Richard.
Hi, I'm Dick Hickman. I'm originally from River Valley, graduate of in 1967. Went in the United States Navy in 68 through 72. Vietnam for 21 months, and enjoyed it. It was worth it. So I'm going to turn it over to my partner here, Richard.
Hi, my name is Richard Schroetz. I played against Dick in football. Well, my team did, and I graduated from Pleasant in 1966. Had a couple years of college here at the branch, and then joined the United States Air Force and became a Vietnamese linguist. I was in for 4 years, and I'll pass that on to the next.
Absolutely.
Hi, good morning. I'm Julie Austin. I was in the Air Force. I graduated from Harding in 1981 and went in the service in 1983. And I retired from the Air Force in 2004.
All right.
I'm Randy Draspa. I'm from Fairmont, West Virginia. I grew up there, and after high school, graduated high school in 1963. Went across the Monongahela River to attend Fairmont State College. Went there for 2 years and decided I needed to go to something else. So I transferred to West Virginia University in 1968. I graduated with a BS in civil engineering. 1 month later, Uncle Sam came knocking, and it took me into, drafted me into the service. I ended up serving in Vietnam from May of 71 to May of 1969 to May of 1970.
Julie, tell us a little bit about your position. What went into that?
In the Air Force, I was a paralegal. I worked in the legal offices, obviously. My role was mainly supporting the troops. And we did a lot of litigation. It was basically an 8-to-5 job with all of our support in the background.
What kind of litigation goes on?
Courts martials. I spent some time with the prosecution and with the defense, both defending troops and prosecuting cases.
Ah, interesting. Now, three Vietnam vets here. Tell me something about the area you were in. Tell me where you were stationed and what the area was like.
I was, for the most part, was in the Delta on the Mekong River. I was on an LST. We were the command ship that supported the Riverine Group, which is a mixture, was a combination of Army and Navy, trying to stop the influx of arms coming from North Vietnam down through the Ho Chi Minh Trail toward Saigon. I worked with the SEAL team on shore bombardment and trying to stop them. They were the spotters. So it could be violent at times. We our sister ship got hit by the swimmers coming down the Mekong. They planted mines on them, killed 26 of our fellow sailors. So we were always on the alert. We drop concussion grenades in the water periodically to get rid of the swimmers. So it was pretty heavy, especially during some of the night ops and stuff. So,
yeah. Richard?
I was a Vietnamese linguist. I was trained by the military to speak, read, and write Vietnamese. And my main goal was to fly, so I was going to be a linguist that flew out of Okinawa, and I was trained to how to bail out of the airplane without bailing out, and they thought that was too dangerous. How to run the ground radios, how to run the aircraft radios, and how to conduct yourself if you were captured, how to escape and evade, to try not to get captured. And after 23 months, and I had orders to go right where I wanted to go, where I was expecting to Okinawa and fly out of Okinawa, we would have then flown over Vietnam, both north and south, Cambodia and Laos, and refueled over the Gulf of Tonkin, and then flown back in, and then back to about a 23-hour flight back to Okinawa. However, in typical military fashion, 2 days before I was to graduate on a Friday and do that, it seems that somebody on a mountain in Taiwan ran out of, I guess they decided they did not want to keep the base open. The Air Force said, let's keep it open. Where can we find 10 guys that know how to speak, read, and write Vietnamese? So they looked in the latest graduating class and took 10 guys from the bottom of the alphabet, and I ended up in Taiwan instead of flying with the rest of my classmates out of a more dangerous area in Vietnam.
Randy, how about you?
Well, after basic training at Fort Knox, Kentucky, I was kept there and I went to assigned to radio school. There we learned how to send and receive short, Morse code, of course, voice, and language, and then also to operate these various types of radios. Radios that were mounted on trailers, as well as radios that fit on your back. And the highest rate of kill in Vietnam was the radio operator. After 5 weeks of an 8-week radio course, for some reason the Army gave us a choice of continue on with that training, or we could opt to go to Fort Gordon, Georgia, at Signal School, and learn how to operate a radio teletype machine. Most of us took that opportunity, and it was an additional 11 weeks of training, and I felt, well, 11 more weeks in the States versus going to Vietnam, that's for me. So most of us took that route. And I ended up, luckily, being assigned to a reconnaissance company in Canto, South Vietnam, and the lower delta, and we flew probably support of Richard's missions over there in the
base I went into when I was going to my ship. was Cant.
Quite a small world.
Wow.
Yes. Mm. So anyhow, we had the Army's largest fixed-wing plane. It was given to us from the Air Force. It was the OM-1. And our company was called the Delta Hawks, 244th Aviation. And they fixed these planes up. They had, looked like a bug as far as the globe on the front. And then it was equipped with all kinds of intelligence gathering equipment. They would fly the missions, bring back the information, and it was given to an intelligence platoon. They would decipher the information, put it into some type of language and so forth, and give it to us, and we would create messages. And this was, you would operate an electric typewriter. It was mechanically hooked to a tape punching machine, which that was popular in that era. Very slow and awkward. So you couldn't sit down and start typing real quick. You had to bring the equipment up to speed very slowly. So anyhow, that's what we used. And we had two large trailer-mounted radios out in the back of the our Quonset hut, which Quonset hut was nicely air-conditioned. I was lucky to be assigned to duty like that. Although we had radios, we also had a landline available, so all we had to do was get our tapes punched out and then take it across the company there at Canto, our base, and we could send it off by landline. Yeah. And these messages went everywhere, all across Vietnam, including back here in the state, several places, and the White House. Now, why would the White House need the kind of information that we were gathering? That's unbeknownst to me, but that's where it went.
Randy and Julie, I'm going to have you take that mic out of there, because sharing a mic, just kind of pass it back and forth when you talk. Just take it out of that holder there. That way everybody can be heard well. Most memorable moment from your experience, good or bad? And we'll start over here again with Richard.
Wow. I think one of the things that got me was when I think I told you a story about every month we had to take supplies up the Mekong River, and it was a voluntary mission, so we manned machine guns. And it went up to the border with Cambodia, and there was a base up there probably of only about 50 men that were Navy guys. And it was a terrible place, because if at night they got hit all night. It was just horrible. And I ran into a friend there, and he was on opium just like everybody else that was there. And I finally got him to, you know, his senses, and I asked him, why are you doing this? You're going to end up getting killed. He says, you know, if you're on the end of the line, you're expendable. And he said, we're already dead. So we use opium to kind of kill the fear. So, it was sad. I never seen him again after that. So,
Richard, what about you?
I think one of the better things that we did, we intercepted, of course, Vietnamese language traffic from ground troops or aircraft and SAM sites, anti-aircraft sites. And I think one of the better missions that we ever had was that, because it was fulfilling, was that there were two fellows were escaped from a Viet Cong occupation group, and the Viet Cong or somebody there on the radio started talking about where these two fellows were and the fact that they'd gotten away. They were Americans, probably, we figured, from an F-4, because that would have been a typical two-man team, a pilot and a radio man, or a guy that ran the equipment. So we worked very hard that night to try to get these two guys rescued. We sent out a search and rescue mission, but of course, as Dick said, some guys you never hear again from. You don't really know how it came out, but I think that was typical of some of the fulfilling jobs that we did. You know, the rest of the time we were intercepting language or coded messages saying where troops might be moving from or to, or where things were stored, and we'd send that information out to the 7th Air Force, and they'd bomb those places. But I think saving people was much more fulfilling.
Julie, most memorable experience?
Well, being in the military for 21 years, I was in a lot of different duty stations. The most memorable was 1999, the year 1999, when I went down to the Panama Canal as part of a caretaker force to withdraw from the zone. We were there for 11 months, and our responsibility was to get all personnel and families, assets, out of the Panama Canal before America let go of, United States let go of the control of the canal.
Did people want to go? Was it easy to get them?
No, it was very, very, very difficult. It was a very sad situation. You had people who were born in the zone who were actually dual citizens, who maybe tugboat drivers who had worked on the canal, who lost their jobs. They had been working, you know, years as tugboat drivers, but because of the loss of control, they no longer had jobs. The families had to move out of their housing, so the zonies, as they called them, it was a very sad situation.
Randy, most memorable experience?
I'm going to talk about arriving and leaving Vietnam. I arrived in Vietnam at Cam Ranh Bay, stayed overnight, got hit with a rocket attack, staying overnight. Next day, they put us on a C-130 and flew us down to Saigon, Tansanit Air Base, stayed overnight, and found it. Had a comrade with me, Richard Golowski. Both of us Polacks, and we're going to the same place. Not only the same company, but the same platoon. And while we're sitting in Tansanit, he had a seizure, and the paramedics came and worked with him, and I thought, I'll never see that guy again. Next day, I'm flown to Canto and get reported into our radio, our signal company, and it was a Quonset hut, and 90% of it was electronic repair shop. And in the back, they had this office where the office was secluded only for us radio teletype operators, because we had a secret crypto classification, and nobody in the platoon had that classification, not even the first lieutenant, who was a pilot, or our master sergeant, who was in charge of the entire company there. They could come into the back of the office and sit there or look in, but they couldn't come in. So every day we set up all the cryptographic radio on the radios, how it was going to scramble the messages going out for the airplanes and all the other radios. Other than that, then we would type up these messages. So ended up working with Richard Golowski for a whole year. He was from Pittsburgh, and he wasn't much worth of anything. He was on drugs, and it was a young kid. I'm 23, so you know, I have been through college and been through a lot, so I was more settled in. But he was in for everything that was going on. You know, marijuana was flowing easy. There was all kinds of drugs that I don't even know. They call it uppers and downers and so forth. He was on it. So we go through the whole year, and it's time to leave Vietnam. And guys from the company, they went down to our small air base there in Canto. There was a tavern, so we all went in and tipped a few. And we heard a plane take off. And we ran outside, and there was two C-123s landed there, and one had taken off. And there was the other one that was taxiing down the runway. I'm short, but Richard Golowski is a lot shorter than me. I picked up my duffel bag, and I ran down the runway and threw my duffel bag, you know, how they lower the gate down. I uh, threw my bag up on the tail end of that C-123 and jumped up on there, and all the soldiers up in there were laughing at me. And then looked back, and there's Goloski. He couldn't make it down there, so I ran back and helped him with his duffel bag and threw it up on the back of the tail and helped him up. And that's how we took off and left Vietnam.
Very, very interesting stories. Now, Vietnam, what kind of a mood was over in Vietnam at this time when the war is going on?
Really, our feelings was really our comrades, our fellow sailors or airmen, whatever. That's what it wasn't country. It was really them. It was to protect each other, to work with each other, to do your job. It had nothing to do with country. So we just every day you did it, and I can only say that back here there was demonstrations, whatever, but not there. We just worked together and we protected each other, our brothers.
Now, were you aware of the demonstrations going on here?
Yeah, somewhat. Yeah.
Yeah. Does that impact anything when you know that's going on?
Not really.
Yeah.
We do our jobs and did it well.
Richard, what was the mood over there where you were in Vietnam?
Well, I was in El Paso, Texas, learning to speak, read, and write Vietnamese, and we had men and women who had come south in 1954 from the DMZ to escape the North Vietnamese, but they spoke Vietnamese with a northern accent. There's a little bit different. So that's the kind of people that they wanted to teach us Vietnamese so we would be familiar with the North Vietnamese. And most of them, it was, I think, it's kind of worldwide. The older people that we saved them in World War II, they still appreciated the country, but the younger people, they seemed to be more less forgiving. You know, they didn't like us quite as well. I had a teacher there that as teachers do sometimes, got off the main topic, and she said that she thought American soldiers were paper tigers. Well, I said some things I shouldn't have said. So then I had to go to, they had a special place for me the next week. If you got, you got graded as you do in school, and that lady gave me a 13 out of 100 for that week. So I had to go to a study hall that week. But, but there were others, you know, the problem, like this lady, I think all of her family was killed. She was the only one left. Now, some of the others weren't as mean-spirited, if you want to say. But now that the people that we intercepted, a lot of it was, as Randy said, we had a crypto clearance too. But some of it was what we call plain text, just a guy speaking Vietnamese and telling about what was going on. And some of them, I remember one guy, you could hear a baby crying in the background. You could hear chickens. So, you know, I mean, this guy was, it was right in a hut someplace, his family, that's where he was working out of. So, like a lot of people say over there, you know, in morning, during the day, they might be your barber or they might be working on base. And at night, they might be the Viet Cong in the black pajamas. Mm. So it just...
You know, to add
it
to
was
that,
a strange war.
Yeah. We would pull into Vung Tau, which is a port city for Saigon, you could go over on Liberty and drink a few beers or whatever. But every place you went into, there was a picture of usually LBJ, or then it became Nixon or whatever. But what you didn't realize is the flip side, they flip it over when the Viet Cong would come in and add Ho Chi Minh on the other side. You couldn't help but laugh.
They were prepared.
Yes.
Absolutely. Randy, what was the mood over there?
It was kind of for the most part, work, get your job done, party hardy when the opportunity presented itself. But I want to say, I told you about the seclusion of the radio group and punching these messages on the tape. Not everybody knew what was going on in there, which turned out to be not so good. They were behind at least 6 months behind in these messages that were coming in from the intelligence and all the money spent to gather this information. They were 6 months behind. So when I reported in, this was just a Spec 4, another radio teletype operator. He says, you know, all of us radio operators don't have any duty, no guard duty, no KP, nothing. And he says, because we're behind. So he says, just keep it that way. And I says, well, what am I going to do? He says, screw around, play cards or whatever. And I said, well, I'm going to spend a whole year playing cards, and I don't really enjoy it that much. And I says, I didn't volunteer for this. I was drafted. They sent me here, and I'm going to do my duty. And so it was a dysfunctional office, and I worked my best to turn it around. And in a matter of several months, we got everything cleaned up. I even got a promotion up. I didn't want it, but I got a promotion out of it. And I felt good about it. But the mood was, there's a lot of racial strife at that point on the base, and I didn't understand it, that where the root of it, where it was coming from. We had some blacks in radio operators. We worked well together, but for some reason there was other groups out there that just couldn't get along. And unfortunately, that was some of the situations we had there down in Canto.
You know, it's a very interesting thing, because we think about World War II, and that generation is getting pretty far along in life at this point. Very few of those veterans left. But there are so many events tied to World War II, like D-Day, which I think is the 80th anniversary this year, and Pearl Harbor, I think, is the 80th anniversary, but D-Day, and there are books written, The Greatest Generation, and a lot of this stuff based on military experience. What was different about Vietnam than that group? It didn't happen all that much long later in the grand scheme of time. World War II, the early 40s, Vietnam, the late 60s and 70s.
We were under Johnson was under the theory that it was a domino theory of the communists would steadily work their way through, and he was going to stop that at all cost. And he sent us there, but we didn't have exactly what we were going to accomplish. That's why it was all over the board. You got to go into war and say, this is what we're going to do, period, and then get out. But we didn't do that. We went there and we just muddled along. We fought our battles every day. We never lost one. But still, we didn't know what the goal was.
What does that do to somebody when you're day-to-day doing this incredible job, but really not knowing what the goal is?
You have to concentrate on your fellow shipmates and working with them. Do your job. Don't worry about the big picture and get done with that and go home.
Richard, what do you make of that? What did you have any idea what the goal was?
No, I don't think. I think there's been several wars, if you want to call them that, or police actions, whatever they want to call it, since World War II, that we really didn't have a goal. And it's cost us in the long run, because we got in places where we maybe had no business and didn't have an end goal. I think one of the big differences between, you're talking about the World War II, you know, in World War II, during that time, whether you were over there or you were on the home front, you were fighting the war. You know, you didn't have tires, you didn't have sugar, you didn't have nylon if you were here. My mother worked in the ordnance plant. A lot of other women in this area worked in the ordnance plant making bombs. And although when my mom and dad's friends would come over, they were all in the military, as are a lot of us who graduated in the mid-60s, a high percentage of us, the war wasn't the same, because that war was to stop you from, we always kidded my Uncle Bob about, good thing he was bombing Germany or we'd all been speaking German. And, a lot of the feeling here, the anti-war protesters said, well, we had no business being over there because it was a civil war. And nobody helped us in the civil war. Why should we be in it? And, of course, some people, some of the some of them went to great extremes, burning their draft cards and going to Canada, cheering on the Viet Cong and things like that. But so I don't think you had the same mindset of the people in the 60s as you did in the World War II. We became, I think, what was known as the Question Authority group there in the 60s. In the, you know, World War II, they said, let's go, and everybody went. And in Vietnam War, of course, we had the Korean War in between there, too. But then in the Vietnam War, it was, well, what are we doing there? And some guys, like the guy sitting here, said, well, it may not be right, but we're going to go anyway. But it wasn't the same feeling, I don't think, as what we had in World War II.
When it comes to Vietnam, there is this long question about when, and even the word. You know, did we win? Did we not win? What's your opinion of this? What happened at the end?
We decided to get out. I mean, the whole thing was is we won every battle. If you do the numerics of it, you know, we lost 58,000 and some. They lost somewhere between 1 million and 3 million. Yeah, numerics, we won. But they outlasted us. They knew that back on the home front, the demonstrators would eventually win. And they did. So we steadily moved to turning the war over to the Vietnamese, which really weren't very good at this job. They didn't have the will. They didn't have that desire for freedoms or whatever. But they didn't fight well. They basically would run away. So there was no chance they were going to survive.
So. Randy, what do you make of that whole situation, how the war ended? Did you have a clear objective as to why you were there?
Well, I think we had a clear objective. You know, we were assigned a duty, and everybody saw to it that they completed their assignment as best they could. When Nixon came in, he changed the program, and I'm not sure I totally understood it. It was they were trying to ease or the confrontations with the enemy. Why would you do that? But anyhow, it was a concept: don't fire until fired upon. And to me, I'm thinking back on that. Even then, it was like, wow, it was just like the Battle of Bunker Hill. Don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes. Well, one night I'm out on guard duty, and our compound had five helicopter companies, and each night we had two helicopters up in the air, one going around with a spotlight, shining the light on the perimeter of the base, and up above was a Cobra gunship coming in to lay down a line of fire if the enemy would attack. And just to show the enemy that they were there, each night they would lay down a ground of fire out on the perimeter. One night, while we were in our bunker, this helicopter with the light got spotted something out beyond the perimeter, and it was, I think, clothes hanging up, and they thought it was a VC. So I couldn't believe how they almost landed that helicopter out there, and finally they drew fire, and all hell broke loose after that. Nothing happened to us, but we just sat back and watched everything take place. But that was part of Nixon's concept: don't fire until fired upon. But look at the danger, that helicopter going in there to draw that fire, and then we react to it. It was just, to me, laying many lives in a dangerous situation that didn't need to be.
Julie, tell me personally what that period of time did for you, that you were involved with the guys, the veterans.
During my service?
Yeah.
Well, a lot of what we did for the deployments. We made sure that the troops had wills, they had power of attorneys, that their families were protected because they were getting on the planes and leaving. I was in Desert Storm and the Gulf War, the beginning of the Gulf War before I retired. And so when we had those mobility things that we had to do, it was basic support. We just made sure that everyone was protected.
When you help a guy or a girl who is young get their will ready, how do you do that? How do they react?
It's scary. The whole thing is scary. Every aspect of being in the military is scary. But you know, we just had to reassure them and just make sure that they knew that we had their back, that we would protect anyone that was left behind, families, wives, husbands, children. That was our goal.
Time's flying by. We're down to the final 10 minutes here, but we are going to do another hour. There is something, a lady called in yesterday when she heard that we were going to be doing this program, and she was, and I hope she's out there listening this morning, I'm sure she is, she was the mother of a Vietnam veteran, and she asked us to please talk about how the Vietnam veterans were treated when they came back, as opposed to other veterans from other wars. So when people realized at that time, what was that time like when you came back or stopped active duty as opposed to now? Has it gotten better?
Oh, it's better. There's no doubt. When I came back, I really wanted to get back into working again and also use the GI Bill to go to school. I was working in Warren, Ohio, which was near Kent State. So I went at night to Kent State. Now, you would think that would be an issue because I was part of the Cambodia invasion, and once they found out, that would be a major issue, but it wasn't in a way, because they treated us veterans so well, and I'll never forget that. They did an outstanding job, so you just can't believe that.
Were the people here good to you when you came back?
The veterans were, definitely. Yeah.
What was the mood amongst the general public at that time?
Wow. I would say somewhat negative towards the war. I think they'd had enough of it. They wanted us out.
Richard, what do you think?
I think what Dick said is true, that I remember, I think when Nixon was in, they said, just declare it a war, have a parade, and bring all the kids home. Or declare it a victory, have a parade, and bring all the troops home. And I don't think that... I think when World War II was over, there was so much more relief because the war had been so close to being lost at different times. There were so many adventures that we had that turned the tides in the Pacific and on D-Day, and it allowed all the people here who had been struggling to help support the troops. It was all one big happy time bringing the troops home. I don't think Vietnam, we weren't supported that much. So, and we didn't come home when it was over. We kind of dribbled in when our time was up. Mm-hmm. And that made a big difference, too. As you said, you went back to school or back to your job or back to your family, whatever. And you just kind of blended in and waiting for the next busload to come home. It wasn't nearly the same.
Randy, what was the mood like coming back then, and what's it like now?
The mood coming back then, like the previous veterans spoke, America was tired of the war and fed up with it. When I landed at the Oakland Army Air Base after a 17 or 18 hour flight from Vietnam, and then I went through discharging procedure, which was another 16 or 17 hours to get discharged from the service, and at the end they throw you a set of dress blues, you put that on, and then they take you out to the airport. So you're half asleep and half awake and aware of things. But when I got up to the counter to get my ticket, it was a Southeast Asian agent, and he was very
extremely rude to me. I mean, it was so much so, it startled me, even though it was so drowsy, it startled me that, and that was the only instance that I experienced. You know, after that was the homecoming. It was fantastic. Went to graduate school and ended up coming to Marion, Ohio, and went to work at Floyd Brown Associates, who had all kinds of retired Army colonels leading the organization. But we didn't talk about it. Nobody talked about their background. But it was just that instance coming back after that. It was just normal life. And today, I think it's flipped over to the other way. Everybody responds well to being a veteran. We have an active Vietnam Veterans chapter here in Marion. This is chapter 1117. Hopefully, Scott, you're going to let me talk about the banner campaign here shortly, but it's completely different today than what it was back when we, 50 years ago, because I just think everybody was sick and tired of the war.
Well, let's get in that banner campaign now, because we're at 55 minutes past the hour. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I had a spiel here to talk about the whole program, how it got started, but it started in a town, a suburb of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. A businessman who lost a family friend, he was killed in Iraq, and he wanted to do something for the family, so he owned a print shop, so he worked with the family and printed up a military banner and placed it out in their front yard. Soon they were inundated with phone calls. Everybody else wanted a banner for their veteran. Today, these military banners fly from all kinds of towns and communities across Pennsylvania. There are 22 communities in Ohio that have these military banners flying in their downtown areas. And this is just the company that we are using. There's other companies that are selling these banners. So there's more than, let's say there's more than 25 communities in Ohio that fly military banners. The whole program got started by the local Korean War veterans wanted to do this program because they went east through Mount Gilead and they saw the banners flying there. They would go through Galleon and see banners there. And they go west and through Kenton and they see Hardin County military banners flying in downtown Kenton. So they wanted Marion to do something. And they said, this is time for the Vietnam veterans to sponsor this program. So that's what we're doing. And I ended up being a committee chairman. But I'm not working alone. I got a committee that includes John Stahlsmith, Jim Wilhelm, Art Chaney, John Danner, Dick McDaniel, and Penny Richardson. She's not a veteran, but she's our banner coordinator, and she's volunteered to help us out. We're starting to sell banners now with the goal of having enough to put up next May, and they will stay up from Memorial Day to this time next year, Veterans Day. At that time, they would be taken down. Where are we going to hang the banners? First, we went to see the Mayor Schertzer, and the city directed us to Downtown Marion, Inc. We met with Clarissa Myers, and she had her executive committee look at our recommendation of hanging the banners along the normal Memorial Day parade route along South Main Street out to Veterans Memorial Park. Well, they came back and said, we'll grant you that request, but we also want to see you hang banners on Church Street starting at Orchard over to Greenwood Street down in front of the new Harding Museum. And then a third location we'll give you is along Mount Vernon, starting at Church Street over to Greenwood Street in front of Harding's home. So that's more than we really asked for. And plenty of utility poles in those areas to hang banners. So all we have to do is just sell enough banners. The cost? These banners cost $135. And here's a banner for you veterans here and at the station with me. These are made of strong vinyl material. It's the same picture on each side. It has some information on the bottom of it. Medals of Valor would hang along the frame. Same picture on each side. And they're 2 foot wide by 3 foot high. The banners come with a fiberglass and stainless steel support bracket that would hang from the utility pole. In addition to the banner, well, you would get that banner that we would hang on the utility poles, plus you would get 2 12-inch wide by 18-inch high banners for the family. And also, the company will create a website. If you go to troopbanners.com, it would the website would contain a picture of these banners, and it would just iterate from one banner to the next. So basically, that's what the program consists of. We can't, the Vietnam veterans can't do this alone. We need a whole lot of help.
Is there a phone number to call?
Yes. To order a banner, first you have to have an application, and you call 419-560-1124. You will speak with Penny Richardson. She will get her banner application out to you, and it provides all the information that we need to put on the banner. And on the back, it gives you the rules and requirements that we have for the banners. And like I say, we can't put the banners up ourselves. We have to rely on the city's public utilities department to do that for us. We can't hang the banners on Ohio Edison's poles without their permission, so we've got to negotiate an agreement with them. We are the poor kids on the block as far as a military organization in Marion County, but we're getting a whole lot of support from the VFW, the American Legions, and without their support, this thing wouldn't have gotten off the ground. So they've given us money, and they say, come back if you need more. And we're doing that to keep the cost down. We're really selling these banners at cost. And the purpose of it is we want to make sure that people coming into Marion knows that Marion is supporting their veterans.
Very, very nice here. Richard and Julie and Randy, thank you for coming in this morning. Thank you for your service. It's been a pleasure. We're going to go to break here and come back and continue on with our Veterans Day salute on this Veterans Day 2021.
BOWGH Radio 107.1 FM, Marion, Ohio, the talking place. Streaming live on the internet at www.wwgh1071.com. Look for us on Facebook by searching WWGH Marion, Ohio 107.1.